Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday afternoon. Scholars from Dartmouth have released a global terrorism forecast for 2016. Among the findings, the Islamic State faces serious barriers to growth. Military efforts against Islamic State have steadily intensified with the accumulation of intelligence against it, which has facilitated targeting and with greater coordination among and operational competence of its diverse enemies. There have been territorial losses and internal strains. But challenges will prompt increased attacks in Europe, Russia, Turkey, and possibly Lebanon and Jordan. The rivalry among jihadi groups could also spur attacks by al-Qaeda and its affiliates. At a time when we're in a presidential election and fear of terrorism is very great in the United States, there's been a great deal of talk among the candidates for president about how we counter ISIS and how real a threat is to the United States. So we are very happy to have as our guest Stephen Simon, who is one of the authors of that global terrorism report. Stephen is a visiting lecturer at Dartmouth College. He was executive director of the International Institute for Strategic Studies. And from early 2011 through the end of 2012, he served on the National Security Council staff at the White House, where he was the senior director for Middle Eastern and North African Affairs. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Stephen. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are also on Twitter, and that is at K Dunn Show. Stephen Simon is going to be with us momentarily. We have lost the connection with him, so we will find it again in just a moment and start our conversation with him. It's a really interesting look at the global terrorist threat. Many people feel that we're not doing very well in fighting ISIS. This report says the reality is the Iraqi army and the police, under the tutelage of the United States and other Western forces, will slowly and at times imperceptibly climb back from the 2014 defeat in Mosul. The Kurdish People's Protection Units, Syria, and the Peshmerga in Iraq will continue to whittle away at the Islamic State territory while cutting off its supply lines. But of course, the panic, and it's understandable, over the group persists throughout the West as it continues to launch terrorist attacks, even as, the report says, its ambitions to entrench the caliphate in the Middle East fray. Public alarm grows thanks to chaotic regional landscapes in which the jihadist violence does figure quite prominently, especially, the report says, in states that have been affected by turmoil of the Arab Spring. Since we will be talking about this issue, we'll be welcoming your phone calls. And we also, of course, would like to inject a little bit of political discussion into this. There, of course, was the horrendous attack in San Bernardino. And immediately, the presidential conversation was directed to terrorism in America. The report does look at the possibility of lone wolves here in the United States, who responds to the pleas of the Islamic State operatives abroad. It is entirely possible here, but the possibility of a major attack, because the caliphate is not developing as promised, that the number of people who are attracted to becoming ISIS fighters is diminishing, and also the tactics that ISIS has used in the territory it has controlled has turned people off to ISIS, many of them because of the way they are being taxed. And there is, in the report, some thought about maybe they will return to tactics of brutality to control their territory. So it's a very interesting report. We always wonder, as we do these shows, who really has the best information about the strength of ISIS? What about al-Qaeda? What about the decision by al-Qaeda to step to the forefront in terrorist attacks, and the controversy, the fighting between those two groups as to which group is going to achieve prominence in this whole area. So it's a really comprehensive report that not too many people have been able to put together, and as a result, it's worthy of our attention. So we're going to talk about it as soon as we reestablish connection with our guest, Stephen Simon, visiting lecturer at Dartmouth College. Just to give you, as we are trying to work this out, a look at tomorrow, we're going to be looking at immigration and deportations during this hour tomorrow, as well as the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to review President Obama's executive order on immigration, why they decided to review that, what exactly they're going to be looking at. The immigration debate weaves its way into many of our conversations about the presidential race and how candidates are dealing with that issue. So we'll be talking about that tomorrow during this hour. Hour two of our program today. Let me get the books. I guess she's done a really interesting analysis of the voting predictability of the office of the president. Something happened. He traces it to 1968, but from 1972, with the exception of 1976, there's been, for Democratic voters, a linear pattern, and Republicans have been more unpredictable in their voting patterns. He, by studying this and what happened in 1968, he has found that the predictions here are pretty remarkable, that you could have determined in 1988 what the elections of 1992 and 1996 were going to be. So Tony Fairfax will be joining us. All right, we've established a phone connection instead of a studio connection. Now Stephen Simon with us. Hi, Stephen. Thanks very much for being with us.
Pleasure's all mine.
You know, it's always interesting that we try to get a handle on where we are in fighting ISIS and fighting Al-Qaeda and what the threat is, and it seems as though the information is kind of willy-nilly. You have done a fairly comprehensive report. Where did all the information come from?
The information was all open-source information. None of it derived from unpublished government sources. So it's really all from news reportage and available information provided by governments, usually on government websites.
Mm-hmm. And one of the major findings that I think goes against what the common wisdom is in America is that the Iraqi army and the police, under the helpful guidance of the U.S. and other Western forces, you say will climb back from their defeat in Mosul, that they are gaining strength.
Yeah, I think that process is already underway. I'm not sure that there was ever any doubt that the Iraqi government, with the help of its friends, could push back ISIS within Iraq. The issue was always whether the political battle following the military battle could be won by the current government in Baghdad. And that political battle will be over a greater inclusiveness and a bigger share of the pie, a proportionate share of the pie, for the Sunni population that now feels sufficiently alienated to have joined up with rebels like ISIS. So militarily, not such a terribly hard fight, but politically, possibly an unwinnable one.
Mm-hmm.
All that comes down to the Iraqi government and its policies.
How significant have the territorial losses been for ISIS?
Well, I don't have it down to the square meter. Pardon me. Although I know that's not really what you were asking. I think, look, the territorial losses have been significant. They haven't yet been crippling. I expect over time it will get there. They've been pushed out primarily of places that they have occupied in Syria. And, of course, in Iraq, the loss of Ramadi was a very serious one, I think, for ISIS. And the government now, with the cooperation of the United States and others, is preparing to make a go at Mosul. That will be an extremely hard fight. And I don't believe anybody's quite ready for that fight, but it won't be long before they consider themselves to be. And what's left of Mosul, of course, after that, after the battle, is not inspiring to contemplate. But nevertheless, I think they will go in and they will expel ISIS from Mosul.
Do we have any sense, you mentioned in the report 30,000 people who have come from all parts of the world to join forces to fight with ISIS. Do we have any idea of if those numbers are decreasing, Stephen?
Well, what we do know is that the quantity of ISIS propaganda that has been instrumental in attracting recruits has diminished. when you're in a very tough fight, it's hard to keep up your propaganda, your media machine, even as you're fighting off the enemy that's shooting at you. So there has been a palpable lessening of the propaganda, and that will help. European governments, in cooperation with Turkey, now are trying harder and will probably be more successful in keeping out bad actors, malefactors, from getting to Syria and getting back. But the flow will be very hard to interdict entirely, and I think that's probably beyond the ambitions of the concerned governments right now.
Mm-hmm. As we're seeing the strength of ISIS diminish some, what about the strength of al-Qaeda?
Well, al-Qaeda had some very serious reverses, as we all know, beginning with the killing of bin Laden in 2011. They have not been terribly active in terms of their foreign offensive agenda, but they haven't gone away. And right now, they're involved in essentially a game of one-upmanship, a bidding war with ISIS over resources, the loyalty of members, the availability of recruits, and over strategic issues. And, that kind of rivalry may wind up precipitating a greater number of attacks because, a bidding war is just that. When you're bidding for recruits, you have to show that you're more active and you're more successful and you're more energetic and dynamic and all that than the other guy. So we will be seeing that, I suspect.
In 2016, the report says airstrikes by the U.S. and coalition partners, particularly in Syria, I assume you're referring to, will continue to become more effective as the intelligence base grows. We're getting collection from unmanned aerial vehicles, human sources, growing cadres of human sources. Can you tell me more about that intelligence base and how much more intelligence we're getting and where is the valuable intelligence coming from?
Pardon me. As in Iraq, the flow of intelligence is cumulative. The more the more you know, the better you can contextualize and interpret new information that you get. There's a framework of knowledge and understanding into which you can fit those new incoming bits of data. So the cumulative process is quite important, but, cumulative implies, the passage of time. I mean, it just takes time to gather that information and begin to develop a coherent picture of the enemy. Now, the intelligence derives from many sources. To some extent, I need to be vague about this because these things are, not secret for nothing. But information is gathered through the interception of communications, and that becomes more effective over time as you learn more about who is actually doing the talking, and you can begin to make diagrams that connect phones, phone numbers, and therefore people from one to another. Imagery, of course, is important as well. There are cameras up there that are taking pictures of people and installations and vehicles and so forth, tracking their movement. All this is cobbled together, and it's cobbled together into a coherent picture of who is where, who is talking to whom, and who is moving from what place to which other place. You also get a handle on what their installations are, their important installations. So, for example, coalition aircraft have destroyed caches of cash. Literally hard currency in the most, literal sense of the term. People learn about where these installations are and what's stored in them through the interception of communications. And also, when intelligence agencies get lucky, through the exploitation of physical data that is gotten, say, by special forces teams that might raid a safe house and grab computers and find on the computers a lot of data that enable them to refine their targeting of this organization. And there's also straightforward human intelligence, you know, walk-ins, spies, and others, whose information can be tallied and aligned, double-checked, really, against information that's acquired through technical means. And, you know, all this is happening 24/7, and it's been happening for a year now. You know, the longer this goes on, the more refined, the more granular, and the more accurate the picture the U.S. and its coalition partners will have of ISIS's personnel, its operations, and its capabilities, and all that in turn, you know, gives you your target list.
Mm-hmm. Are there a lot of defectors we're talking to?
Well, you know, defectors of ISIS?
Yes.
ISIS, yeah, yeah. Those, my understanding is that those defectors are interviewed for information they might have that will be useful to the targeting effort. But I think their main utility at this point is in their credibility as media interlocutors to get out there and say, well, you know, actually, we went down there, we saw what ISIS was doing, and we got out of there because we didn't like what we saw.
As we are in a presidential year, of course, there has been conversation, particularly after San Bernardino, about how prepared we are to fight a terror threat, how worried we are, and we appear to be pretty worried in this country about the possibility of an attack. You assess who might be at greatest risk here, and the threat to the United States, not huge, but certainly it's hard to predict this lone wolf, of, as we discovered here in Milwaukee when the FBI yesterday thwarted an attempt that had been planned for the Masonic Temple in Milwaukee, where the person was going to kill 30 people, and that was stopped yesterday. How difficult is it going to be, and how capable are places like the FBI in the United States at discovering these people who may be lone wolves?
Well, the problem, excuse me, the problem, as you implied, is that if they're lone wolves with no record, they're difficult to catch in advance of their actions.
Mm-hmm.
Because they haven't done anything to attract attention. The U.S. law enforcement and intelligence agencies pay close attention to social media nowadays. And I think between social media and family and friends who might be concerned about, you know, altered behaviors of their friends, between those two things, there isn't a lot that's available to law enforcement and intelligence to get these people in advance and either deter attacks by them or disrupt plots that they have that they've set underway. Fortunately, the U.S., as compared, say, to Europe, has a much better integrated Muslim population. American Muslims,
mm-hmm,
are generally better assimilated. They're more a part of the fabric of, you know, run-of-the-mill, garden-variety American society. The Pew Polling Organization, which has collected a lot of survey data on Muslims as well as on other American religious groups, titled their publication on Muslim attitudes, American Muslims Mainstream was the word that they used. And in fact, they largely are. And it's interesting, if you dig down into the data and you look at some of the questions that Pew posed to Muslim respondents, there's a question, you know, do you consider your religion first or your nationality first? Are you Muslim first or are you an American first? And the majority of Muslim respondents said, well, we're both, you know, at the same time. We're American and we're Muslim, and the one doesn't come before the other. Interestingly, Christian respondents replied to that question differently. And more Christian respondents said that actually their religion came before their
nationality. Yeah.
Quite a fascinating thing.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, you know, economically, socially, and in other important respects, we don't have, at least thus far, the problems with disgruntled Muslim Americans that say the Europeans have with Muslims who are situated in their own societies. The other thing is that, you know, our border controls are quite tight. So it's very difficult to get in to the United States. It's certainly much more difficult than it was in 2011 and 2001. And since that time, the United States has probably spent close to $1 trillion on homeland security of, you know, in one way or another. And we do see the results. We do see them.
Mm-hmm. We'll give you a chance to pause your voice for a moment. I'm sorry you're not feeling very well. You're a trooper for joining us. We're looking at a report that has been done by scholars at Dartmouth, one of them joining us this hour, Stephen Simon, visiting lecturer at Dartmouth. He, for a couple of years, was on the National Security Council staff at the White House, senior director for Middle Eastern and North African Affairs. Obviously, people are still worried about terrorism in the United States. New York Times, CBS poll from December showing that we are more fearful of a terrorist attack than any time since 9/11, that we believe an attack is very likely to occur on U.S. soil during the next few months, and 7 out of 10 people say the fight against ISIS is going badly. The report shows that the fight against ISIS is really not going all that badly, that we are climbing back from a defeat in Mosul, that we have Kurdish People's Protection Units, and we have other forces, a coalition that has been fighting ISIS, and some of what has been done in terms of airstrikes, in terms of human sources, unmanned aerial vehicles, defectors, gathering of intelligence has made the fight against ISIS more productive than it has been in the past. But there are parts of the world, and because ISIS may feel that it's losing some of its grip, the possibility of attacks may be greater, and the report looks specifically at countries like Russia, Turkey, Jordan, Lebanon, where there may be more terrorist attacks, and also in Europe. As to North America, no defenses are foolproof, the report says, but there, of course, is the possibility of a lone wolf who responds to the pleas of the Islamic State operatives, that is entirely possible, and it's very hard to guard against that. So what do you make of all of this? Do you feel that the terrorism threat is greater than it has been since 9/11? Does it worry you? Does it factor into your decision as to who is most appealing among the presidential candidates in addressing this? Do you think that we have made some progress against ISIS? But as they try to become number one in terms of being an effective terrorist organization, what about Al-Qaeda? Will Al-Qaeda achieve more prominence? Do we have more of a threat now from them than we do from ISIS? We welcome phone calls for our guest. And here's how you reach us. 800-486-8655 is our number on the Ideas Network. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. For you to join the conversation, we're looking at an analysis of the global terrorism forecast for 2016 this hour with Stephen Simon, a visiting lecturer at Dartmouth, and he was also on the National Security Council staff at the White House, senior director for Middle Eastern and North African Affairs. Lines are open for Stephen. We start our calls with Jordan in Marengo. Hi, Jordan.
Hey there.
Hi.
I'm mostly just calling to reference Senator Ron Johnson's recent statements that Obama has absolutely no plan at all for battling ISIS. And if you unpack that just a little bit, if there was a plan, why would we telegraph to ISIS what the plan was? And if indeed there was no plan, why would we telegraph that fact to ISIS either? So clearly, it's just a very political statement with no grounding in actual political fact. And the thing is, this fear-mongering that's coming out of the right wing now, I think, is counterproductive because fear becomes an addiction in itself, and we're giving them exactly what they want. They want the notoriety. They want the sensation that they're beating us because we're scared silly of them. So that's pretty much what I have. So thanks for the show.
Thanks very much for the call, Jordan. Stephen.
Makes a lot of sense to me.
What about this fear level in the United States? The numbers that we have cited a couple times this hour, that we are more fearful of a terrorist attack now than at any time since 9/11. Is that a result of a presidential campaign that sees this as a winning issue to get people fearful?
No. One of the interesting things about the polling data, if you kind of pick them apart, is that the fear levels are much higher among Republicans than they are among Democrats. And there are probably a lot of reasons why that's the case, but it's certainly true that the Republican candidates have been marketing fear as a political tool. I suppose, you know, their handlers believe it's a useful thing to do. But the Democratic candidates are concerned with a whole other set of issues and haven't really addressed themselves very intensively to this issue, in part because they sense that it's not a top issue for their constituency, and in part because I think they just have a better handle on the actual facts of the matter and, you know, aren't seemingly as panicked by the threat of ISIS as the Republicans are.
Mm-hmm. What does it do to an election, though, if you have, and God forbid there should be one, and I almost hate to ask this, but if there is another, say, lone wolf attack or something like San Bernardino, what does it do to the election conversation? Does it immediately make people more identify with Republicans because they think they're tougher on terrorism, or with Hillary Clinton because she may be tougher than Bernie Sanders? What does it do?
Well, excuse me, I think to some extent it depends on the nature of the attack. If it's a San Bernardino attack, I think, you know, Americans can wrap their minds around that and not get too carried away. It didn't seem to be connected to core ISIS. It didn't seem to be part of a larger conspiracy. These people seem to have talked themselves, you know, into a frenzy and then acted on it in a horrible and tragic way. But it seemed unconnected from a broader threat. And so if there's another attack like it, I think it will, as the first one did, turn the conversation to terrorism, certainly for a while. But then, you know, it'll sort of die down and other issues will come to the fore. If, on the other hand, there is a devastating attack that's clearly traceable to either Al-Qaeda or ISIS, it's going to reinforce Republican arguments that something is seriously wrong and the United States has not acted in ways that might have prevented the attack. And they'll advocate, you know, a very, very tough response, which might or might not be relevant to the actual problem.
Mm-hmm. Our number is 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you right now. Doug in Gays Mills is next. Hi, Doug.
Hi. Say, I just wanted to comment about it just seems like a lot of the news media wants to turn terrorist activity, attacks on America, into it being America's fault. Yesterday on the public radio, there was a fellow, I believe, from Texas, professor. He said the biggest threat to America was Christian middle-aged males. I just found that comment just ridiculous. One thing that I think people are worried about right now is we're not seeing a lot of uprisings with terrorists right now, but a military planner would think that, well, yeah, perhaps what's happening is these people are infiltrating the nation and embedding themselves in here.
You think that's what's happening? People are infiltrating the country?
Why? How could they not? The borders aren't secure. I mean, wherever a lot of these terrorists are in number, there's terrible things happening. What would make America or our president even think that this isn't going to happen here eventually if our borders aren't tightened up?
Stephen.
Well, I'm not aware that anyone is saying that no terrorist attack will take place on American soil ever again. That would be a foolish claim. And again, I don't know anybody who believes that. But the fact is that the borders are extremely tightly controlled, much more tightly controlled, of course, as it turns out, than European borders. are. It's extremely difficult to get into the United States right now if you're if you're a foreigner, and you know you're just checked out really very carefully, and the U.S. Border and Custom Protection Agency errs on the side of caution in granting entry to foreigners. It used to be fairly easy to get into the United States. No more.
Let's talk about Europe for a moment, because everybody was very shaken by what happened in Paris, the whole series of events. The report says that after a decade and a half of post-9/11 underinvestment in domestic security, subpar intelligence and law enforcement cooperation faces a really tough test in Europe. It makes them a possible target, more so than the U.S., Stephen?
Yes, I think they are a more plausible target right now. First of all, proximity to the region that's radiating this kind of violence. Secondly, there's a very large European Muslim population, most of whom are just fine, upstanding citizens and subjects of their countries. But Europe has had a very hard time, in some respects, integrating its Muslim population. That is to say, making that population feel really a part of the country that they have adopted as their own. There are a lot of reasons for that. These are deep waters. I hesitate to wade into them, but it's pretty clear that there are many Muslim youths, at least in some European countries, who feel quite alienated and have turned against the societies in which they live. The combination of that minority of the population, relatively open borders, very large migrant flow, and European societies that tend not to favor, in budgetary and in terms of social practice terms, very strong law enforcement. You know, all that comes together into a bit of, I hesitate to use the term, you know, perfect storm. It's just the wrong combination of factors, and it tends to create a set of conditions or an environment in which attacks are easier to carry out and more likely to happen. The risk is simply higher. The continental Europe has mostly gotten away pretty much free and clear over the course of the past couple of decades, with a couple of exceptions. And the Paris attacks, the series of Paris attacks, really now have changed that. Britain suffered, you know, very heavily a number of years ago in attacks on its own bus and subway system, and that altered policies in Britain in a way that has made them, on the whole, safer. But for all these reasons, Europe is just more vulnerable than the United States is, at least at this stage of the game.
Let's go next to Josh in Eau Claire. Hi, Josh.
Hi. I've been listening for last 20 minutes or so, and you guys have touched on a couple of different groups in Al-Qaeda and ISIS, but you haven't talked about Al-Nusra Front or Al-Qaeda. I'm kind of curious what Steve has to say about them.
Okay.
There are a number of groups in Syria that have ties or have, I think the word people use is jihadist, you know, orientations. They want to make a jihad. Al-Nusra has historical ties to Al-Qaeda and is regarded by many as the Syrian branch of Al-Qaeda. And ISIS in Syria split off from Nusra. They had an ideological battle because ISIS wanted to go its own way and not follow orders from the central Al-Qaeda command. So it split off from Al-Nusra. But Al-Nusra is regarded, I think, by governments as being a serious potential danger and the possible source of overseas attacks, in other words, attempts to attack enemies of the movement outside of Syria, but in other places where they can score points to really draw blood from Western powers.
Let's look at various parts of the world and whether or not they're more likely to be a target. The report mentions Russia and their deployment to Syria being punished by Russian-born Islamic extremists, both domestically and abroad.
You know, well, the Russians have faced serious Muslim insurgencies along its borders and in its hinterlands for quite a while, including a brutal war that lasted many years in Chechnya.
Mm-hmm.
At this stage, ISIS has now declared that it has a kind of a sub-caliphate in the North Caucasus, from which they intend to carry the fight to the Russians. The Russians were already their enemy and were already have long been regarded as an enemy by Islamists and jihadists, but they've elevated their profile in the enemy category by joining the Assad regime in Syria in attacks against ISIS and other Islamist groups. So this is not a big surprise.
All right. Thanks, Josh, for your call. Ray in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Your guest hasn't brought up a single word about drone bombings, and Mr. Obama has increased them 100% from when that horrible Bush was doing it. Now, when we kill people in Yemen, which we are not at war with, when we kill people in Libya, who we are not at war with, when we kill people in Iraq and Syria, the collateral damage happens to be Muslims that are dying. And our president keeps reiterating, we're not at war with Muslims. Yet when we kill them, like last year in Pakistan, over 1,500 innocent people were killed. Those are all Muslims, but we don't call them victims. We call them collateral damage. And for the guests to say that our borders are tightened, have you been to Canada lately or to Mexico? You can walk across thousands of miles of American border, yet I myself am not going to fall into this, be afraid of terrorists. You need to be afraid of the kids in your city, like in the city of Milwaukee with 150 murders last year, with children being murdered, the mass shootings Americans are doing to themselves. This is the real tragedy, and all this hype about terrorism is just so we can keep our war machine going full tilt. The water problem in Flint, Michigan could have been handled by not building one B-52 bomber.
Stephen, you want to respond?
I think that, look, it's hard to take exception to what this gentleman was saying. First of all, the loss of civilian lives among Muslims in these war zones is tragic, and it doesn't help in terms of inculcating favorable views of the United States. Just it doesn't, and I think that's quite obviously true. The issue is how you bring a fight to your real enemies in a way that's completely safe. And people haven't yet figured that out. I mean, you know, looking at this issue historically, we're obviously a long way from the firebombings of Dresden and Hamburg and Berlin and so forth in World War II, where civilians were very deliberately the targets, and the Allies tried to kill as many as they could in the hope of breaking the enemy's will. We're very far from that point, but obviously, you know, the nature of warfare and the nature of even very discriminating weapons is not such that civilian casualties can be entirely avoided. This is just, you know, it's a brutal conundrum, and I share the caller's concern over it. I really do. In terms of other sources of violence against Americans, yes, Americans, you know, tend to be very violent, you know, to and among themselves. But that's a separate issue, of course.
Ray, thanks so much for your call. We'll take more in just a moment. And our guest this hour is Stephen Simon. He's one of the scholars who released a report just recently, Global Terrorism Forecast for 2016. It's an analysis for the Combating Terrorism Center at Dartmouth. And Stephen is visiting lecturer at the college. He's a former senior director for the Middle East and North Africa at the National Security Council. And we're welcoming phone calls. The report looks at how real the strength of ISIS, the strength of al-Qaeda. If ISIS is losing some strength, and if our attempts to fight them have been successful, and if so, how successful, and where are we getting information about whether or not they're losing strength? Who's facing the most threat right now in terms of an attack by ISIS? Is our fear justified in the United States? Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. A couple lines are open for you right now. You can also use Twitter, email talk@wpr.org. Or you can go to Facebook, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show, where we love to read your comments. Or you can go to Twitter, @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls. We go next to Mike in Franklin. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Stephen. I'm really happy to hear you. I've been one thing that's been bothering me, and it's been bothering me for the last 7 or 8 months, and that is we have an expert, Adam Zubin, okay, and he's very good at denying finances to terrorist groups. He's done it already. He has a proven track record. And for some reason, he got nominated for a position, and for some reason, the Republicans keep blocking that nomination. And I would think if we have an expert denying finances, that should be one of our top priorities.
Are you familiar with this, Stephen?
Well, Adam Zubin is a first-rate a civil servant. He's one of, you know, these precious commodities, you know, a real expert and man of action that, you know, propaganda says, well, we don't have in the government. But actually, we're very lucky to have those kinds of people. And Adam has been tireless. He's been indefatigable in chasing down terrorist finances and working with other countries, counterparts in other countries, to close off those financial channels to these groups who want to use their money to kill Americans and other innocent people. You know, from my personal perspective, it's a shame that he can't win this position for which the administration has put him up for. But, you know, in the United States today, politics trumps policy. It just does. And we're seeing that play out in Congress. I'm not sure we can really do anything about that.
I want to talk a little bit about the areas under the control of ISIS. The report talks about a reliance on taxation of residents in the territory there, extortion, really. Such efforts to raise funds further diminishes its popularity and heightens resentments. It had edged away from a strategy of intimidating the populace through overwhelming brutality. ISIS may see no alternative but to return to it.
The organizations like ISIS, or indeed authoritarian regimes, need to balance repression with co-optation. In other words, they need to combine the carrot with the stick. And, you know, to the extent that carrots aren't all that effective, well, then the stick becomes more essential. And I think we'll see the balance between carrot and stick in ISIS-held areas vary depending upon the attitudes of the population, the local representatives of the ISIS headquarters, the people who are actually running that area. I mean, to be sure, ISIS sees its best advantage in winning the cooperation, the active and willing cooperation of people under its control. But they're not at all hesitant, quite obviously, about using sticks. And taxation is quite important to them. It's an important source of revenue, and they really can't afford to lose it. So to the extent that they can maintain some semblance of normal life, if I can put it that way, in areas they control, and keep commerce going, well, the more likely it is that they're going to have a revenue flow that they can use to sustain their authority in those areas, their control.
Josh sends this email, Stephen. I'm curious what criteria is used to determine whether we're winning our fight against ISIS and other jihadist groups.
Well, I think to some extent it's a numbers game. And that those numbers consist of, you know, acreage. You know, how far are you pushing them back? You know. Secondly, it's how much of their stuff are you destroying? And how much of the stuff that you're destroying is irreplaceable? And, you know, ISIS is not on the international arms market. They can't bring in tanks and things like that. So the more you destroy, the weaker they're going to be. They're not going to be able to move their forces around. The more control you exert over airspace also limits their mobility, because the minute they mass out in the open, they become a target and they're subject to attacks against which they really can't defend themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then you just look at the number of people you're killing, and you know, intelligence gives you a sense of how many people you're killing. And then it just becomes really like one of those classic algebra problems, if you remember from your SATs.
No.
Well,
go ahead.
You know, if you've got, you know, 2 gallons a minute coming out of your drain in the tub.
Right, right.
Oh, empties 1 gallon a minute. How long does it take to empty the tub?
Right.
You know, so I don't think that it's all that obscure, actually.
Let's go to, thanks, Mike, Ron in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Yeah. I was just listening to what you were just talking about, and, you know, a great way to get rid of ISIS in Iraq is to include the Sunnis in the Iraqi government. Because if you're a Sunni in northern Iraq, who are you going to trust? Are you going to trust Shia militias like Hezbollah? Or are you going to trust Sunnis, whether it be ISIS or whether it be some other Sunni group, which, you know, ISIS in Iraq is a lot of former Ba'ath Party members and you know, people from, you know, around the world. And,
all right, we got the point. Stephen.
No, I couldn't agree more. At the outset of my remarks in response to one of the questions, I said, well, you know, there's a military battle that needs to be followed by a political battle. And who knows how that political battle is going to be worked out. That political battle I was referring to is exactly the one you were just referring to. In other words, it's the battle over whether and how alienated Sunnis will be brought back into the political fold in Iraq and made to feel part of a unitary, a cohesive Iraq.
We have time for one more call. It will have to be brief. Jamie in Waupaca. Hi.
Hello?
Hi, Jamie.
Hey. What I was concerned about, the people that I know and that I talk to aren't the least bit concerned about ISIS or any of that. Very seldom do that come up in a conversation. You hear more about if I'm going to be able to afford a new pickup this year or next year, how come the price of the groceries going through the roof and the farmers' products are actually in abundance, and how come the part about the rich having all the money and a day's wages buying nothing really what scares the people. Thank you. I'll listen to that.
All right. Thanks, Jamie. Stephen, about 30 seconds.
That really sums up the Democratic agenda. That's what they're focused on. That's what Democratic voters are focused on. So you're not going to hear much about, you know, fear of ISIS from that side of the street.
Mm-hmm. Well, Stephen, I hope you feel better. I'm sorry. You got a cold.
Oh, yeah, it's bad. It's bad. But, you know, with any luck, you know, I'll pass away tonight and it'll all be over.
You have a lot of work to do, sir. That can't happen.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Well, thank you for your hospitality. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for being with us, and get a good nap, several good naps. Stephen Simon, our guest, talking about the global, actually it was a study done at Dartmouth looking at the assessment of global terrorism. forecast for the year 2016. He's a lecturer at Dartmouth, former senior director for the Middle East and North Africa at the National Security Council. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour, and to Scotty as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. News is coming up from National Public Radio, and then we're going to be talking about the presidential trend, the voting predictability. It's a remarkable story.